Welcome to the Industry Talks podcast. I'm your host, Roman Perry. Our Hear It Now event on August 21st was a massive success. I want to give a shout out to WeWork, Sweetgreen, and Bose for helping us to make it happen. And a special thanks to our panelists, Matt Morris, Nicole Plantin, and Matt McFarlane. I also want to thank Finding Novion, Olivia Grace, and Axel Mansur for writing and showcasing their amazing music. This week, we have Jason Kramer. He's kind of a jack of all trades. He's been in the music industry for a while. You may know him from DJing late on Tuesday nights on KCRW. He's also got a really interesting career in music management and music supervision. He's somebody that has been around the music industry and just around music for the past 20 years here in Southern California. He sheds a lot of light on what it was like to grow up back then and how music has changed throughout the time that he's been involved with it. He's somebody that has a lot of wisdom, and there's a lot you could learn from him. So without further ado, here's the episode.
Industry Talks.
We are rolling.
Okay.
Jason Kramer.
Is present.
Welcome to the Industry Talks podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
Of course.
Do you remember that in school where you have to raise your hand when they ask you, are you here?
Yes, and you have to say present here.
It was awful. I think eighth grade was probably the worst time that, because you're going through the changes.
Yeah.
And you'd have to say that, and hopefully your voice didn't crack.
I was homeschooled, so I actually...
Oh, okay. Well, you have no idea
awkward.
What it's like.
I remember saying present when I was in, like, you know, grade school.
Right.
But through my middle school years, I was actually homeschooled, so I skipped the whole awkward stage.
Oh, you messed up, man.
Yeah. I had a very awkward sophomore year of high school when I rejoined.
Why?
Because I went back to high school.
And it was just weird?
Yeah, because I didn't have to go through any of those growing pains, so I had to like just go through all those growing pains in middle school.
So you have a weak
spot
I could kind of hone
you probably
in.
Could okay, right. In some way
good
or another.
So how are you? You good?
I'm doing great.
All right, good.
I'm very good. How are you?
I'm good.
All right.
You got your little red book there. You're gonna look in your notes.
Yeah, my questions.
I told you
book.
you're not gonna look up questions today.
I'm not gonna look up
it's
questions.
It's all gonna be in your
all
head,
right.
Man.
We're
just gonna do it. Do it
shoot,
free.
I'm gonna shoot from the hip today.
You're gonna shoot from the hip.
Cool. Because
you memorized it all, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Well, I wrote it down, so then I memorized
then it's
it.
In here.
Now it's in.
There you go.
Do you want to take a second to introduce yourself and tell the people what you do and,
sure.
and what you get into?
My name is Jason. Last name is Kramer. And I am, well, let's start, you know, I don't even know what I am, to be honest. I kind of get really, not bored, but my mind kind of wanders all over the place. But I could say that I am a radio DJ.
Okay.
I'm a lapse music supervisor, only when I get hired.
Okay.
I music management,
mm-hmm.
music photography. I should just say photography. What else have I, an educator.
Okay. You do a lot.
Yeah, I do a lot.
Yeah.
It's just kind of whatever comes to mind or things I just like to do, I end up doing them.
Cool.
It's my habit. It's my,
all right.
my the way of, I think and do things. And
do you have a favorite thing that you like to
no,
do?
No, absolutely not.
No.
I mean, it's everything.
It varies on a
yeah. I mean, look, I love
basis,
radio,
probably.
Obviously. I mean,
yeah.
I've been doing it for 20 years. Supervision, probably the same thing. Teaching, I used to, you know, I've taught for the last, I guess about 6-7 years.
Okay.
Through universities. But prior to that, when I had an old career, when I worked on as an ambulance on the medic,
mm-hmm.
I was a field training officer. That means that all the new recruits would come in and I would teach them,
yeah.
you know, what it's like. And I would be, you know, they would be the third person on the ambulance or the rig or whatever.
Right.
And as a field training officer, you kind of throw them in situations. And yeah, so I started doing the ambulance stuff starting probably my just as I graduated high school.
Okay.
But I worked in a hospital when I was 17.
Right.
Working in, because I went for my first job, I was 17, and it was at Santa Monica Hospital, and I made a smart ass comment, not as a bad one, just being goofy. And the person there that was giving us the opportunity to, you know, not the opportunity, but they were kind of like showing us around the hospital and all this kind of stuff, said, mm-hmm. fine, you're going to be on this floor. And I'm like, okay, this is it. So I'm an in-house tech. Turns out that, mind you, I'm 17. Turns out that floor, and this was in 1987, was fourth stage oncology, which is cancer,
right,
and final stage AIDS.
Okay,
right.
So, and like almost like a hospice floor.
It was a hospice, absolutely. Okay. But at that time, you know, medicine wasn't what it was. And seeing folks that had AIDS back in the 80s, especially late 80s, was
right.
just horrific.
Yeah. I mean, that was like the really
yeah, and mind
time.
You, I'm 17. So,
yeah.
you know, this is nothing that I was ever around my whole life. And you kind of get thrown into the pit and the fire right away.
Right.
So that kind of set up my background and my life of how I view things. And then eventually working at the hospital, I became on the code blue team. And that's when there's a heart attack in there. You know, either do CPR or you bag. And that became just, you know, a constant thing as well.
Yeah.
Then I graduated and working in surgery, working in the ER. And then by the time I was 18, this isn't within the first year or so, I became auxiliary with LA City Fire Department. And my first, you know, I mean, I don't want to start this off as morbid, but
right.
my first call was a homicide.
Okay.
And I remember that distinctively, where it was, who it was right on Robertson. And it became actually a newsworthy case, the thing as well. And as time goes on, you know, I started working on the ambulance. I worked in the riots and all this and that. So I became the field training officer. Point was that I started getting really angry, mm-hmm. right? Like mad. And what I mean mad is I would go back to the station, I'd be at home and something would trigger me and I would hit something. You know, I never people, you know?
Yeah.
But you hit inanimate
object. Like you'd stub your toe
or something. No, you know, you find a door and all of a sudden you just kind of snap and you slam that door hard or you just take your fist and you punch the wall.
Yeah.
And, you know, at that point, I realized what you could call today was kind of like pre-PTSD at that time.
Right.
Right? So I realized that this isn't a healthy world for me any longer because it's really hard to compartmentalize everything. Oh, and I did 2 years county coroner, so I was like helping, you know, living and then next thing, doing forensics on
yeah.
the deceased.
Yeah.
And you realize this is really hard on the body. This is hard on the soul. It's hard on the mind. When you knock on someone's door every single day, it's not for a good thing, you know?
Yeah.
So that just got me to a point where I was not happy doing this. But halfway while I was in this career, I started answering telephones at KLOS Radio out here. And it was Uncle Joe Benson who was on. This was in 92. And I realized I love this radio thing. There's something about radio I absolutely love.
Right.
And I think that's kind of like growing up with a family in entertainment and also just, you know, hearing my cousin who worked at KTLA also, and he was a big radio buff. And my earlier cousin also a radio guy. So it was kind of like almost like this calling within my family, you know. Like you with music.
Yeah.
You know, same thing. So halfway through, I started doing the radio. And then one day, my friend who was going to Santa Barbara College, UC Santa Barbara, he gave me this CD. And I fell in love with it in 2 seconds. And that was the band Sublime.
All right.
And I had started writing letters and notes to the label. Because on the back then, you get like a CD and it had like an address on the back.
Right.
So, you know, there was no internet. There was no, that was fan. And you just kind of like wrote letters and all that. And half the time they write back, you know. And so I think it was about a year of pestering that they finally let me come in.
Yeah.
And while I was working on the ambulance on my days off, I was working at KLOS mm-hmm. and also working with Skunk Records and Sublime. So I realized this is something that we really, really, really like is that world. And it wasn't until about after Brad had died in 96, because I started there in 94,
right.
that I was tired. I was just worn out. I was tired. I didn't want to work on the ambulance anymore. And I left and through basically kind of through nepotism, I got a job at Fox Sports, and
really?
It was to work at Fox Sports Music at that time. And this was the first network TV station that had a music department of that size.
Really?
Yeah. And this was Fox Sports Net, and there was about three of us. We had Fox Sports and Fox Sports Net, and I was part of the net part. And there was three of us to kind of craft and develop this cool TV station.
Yeah,
is what it was. So we did that. I was there for about 6 years. You go backwards, and KCRW was doing an event at the Pally Center, which is, I forget what it's now called. And Michael Stipe was there doing this event. And I talked to one of the engineers, Steve, who was there, and I said, how do I get into working at the station? What do I need to do? It's part of, like, you know, we were talking prior about how you have goals and you set your world into goals.
Yeah.
Imagine no internet. You know,
yeah.
Today it's different. Because I worked on the fire department thing and
yeah.
stuff, you kind of learned these cliches, these mantras of what do I need to do?
Right.
How do I make this better?
Right.
You know, and you start doing these questions, right? And
right.
it's the same kind of training that you would do in paramilitary training as well. You know, it's like you have them ask questions and have them ask, you know, also ask the answers as well.
Yeah.
So what do I need to do? He told me, he said, come down, you know, you'll start volunteering and so on and so forth. And I did that for about a year on an overnight show. And then eventually they gave me my own show, and that was in 1997.
Okay.
So it's been about 21 years now there.
Yeah. At KCRW.
Yes.
What is your show like?
Me and the crew that works with me, we kind of developed it as a show where we want to kind of find newer artists, not necessarily in the United States, but all across the world.
Yeah.
Artists that will eventually have a career in music.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's a certain sound that you kind of hear.
Yeah.
Let it be indie pop or rock. I mean, we don't hold back. And if I'm able to give an opportunity to an artist that's just starting out to do it, then to me, that's best I could do for somebody.
Okay.
Coming from that background again of medicine in,
right.
in that world.
What
how can
need?
I help you?
Yeah, how can you help?
What do I need to do to help you?
Yeah.
You know, so.
Just kind of give a platform for those types of artists.
Yeah.
Are there any notable artists that you gave a platform for back in the day?
There's quite many, but
okay.
I'd rather not say.
Okay.
Only because that it's not about me.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But there's quite a handful. So.
Okay, cool. How has the type of music changed over the years that you've played, and has your taste changed at all? Like as far as
no, still on the weekends I listen to reggae.
Okay.
And that's it.
Yeah.
6 o'clock I shut off the music.
Okay.
You know, I have certain hours because my hobby became my career.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And so once your hobby becomes your career, you still want to make sure that you still enjoy it.
Right.
Because people whose hobbies become their career, after a while they get burnt out and
then
they got no more hobby.
Yeah.
So I always figure that, you know, if this is your career and this is your hobby, let's have some quiet time on it.
Right.
And let's kind of, it's like sleep, you know, you rejuvenate when you go to bed.
Yeah.
And so it's the same thing.
Like you got to make sure you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, and on the weekends when we listen to reggae, it's a whole different story.
Right.
Because that's my escape.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah. And that's kind of like you're reminding yourself why you liked doing what you're doing and why you're into doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
It's important.
What about you?
As far as like what kind
you
of music
you come from music, when do you turn it off?
As far as like the work versus hobby thing, like I look at music more as work than I do. I love music, and don't get me wrong, but I've always treated it like, or I've always tried to treat it more as like professionally as I can, mm-hmm. Just because I kind of grew up seeing it done on the professional level.
Yeah,
and I mean, I like performing a lot. That's the thing that really gets me going more than anything else.
Are you shy?
I would say that I am, but I'm probably not. It depends on the situation. I mean, everybody's shy.
Yeah, but when you go on stage, a lot of artists, you know, when they're on stage, all of a sudden the shyness kind of disappears.
Nah, I can cut loose. It depends on how much I've practiced. Right. I think if I've done my work and if I've practiced, I don't need to be shy.
Yeah.
But if I know that I could have practiced more,
right,
I definitely will end up being shy.
Right.
I started off like DJing and stuff like that. That was my introduction to music. Was like selecting and DJing and,
you know, you asked
doing
me
that stuff.
Has music
like
changed?
Party DJing?
Yeah. Has music changed?
Yeah.
It has.
Yeah.
And it's not for the worse or for the better. It just, you know, it's constantly changing.
Right.
I kind of think we're in a pendulum swing right now. Mm-hmm. For the last 20 years.
Yeah.
We're kind of picking up what was. And it's kind of funny to me because I listen to, you know, being as my age and also listening to, you know, growing up. Okay, so my first two records when I was seven, this was in 1978. Was Bob Marley's Exodus and the Magical Mystery Tour by the Beatles.
Right.
And my uncle gave this to me, and he actually took a picture of me at, it was at San Francisco City International Airport, mm-hmm. right? And there's a picture of me holding the two records, and I remember that. And today, you know, I still listen to that Bob Marley, you know, record on a constant. It's kind of as a safety blanket to me. And I think the only difference with how music has changed is there's a loss of manipulation with the music. There's a loss of manipulation with the fans.
Okay.
And what I mean is we have this world that we kind of live in the box and on the phone, and outside of that, there's nothing there, you know?
Right.
It's like watching a show, a cartoon or whatever on the thing. You're just watching it. You're not really immersed into it. And we did all this stuff with Sublime. We would actually... So there used to be a thing that says lyrics in the background, send $1.
Right. Yeah.
And I remember we got the note, and I said to one of the guys there, I'm like, what do? We have all this money for it. And we didn't have any lyrics because I asked for lyrics. And I remember there was a... Dead Kennedys CD, and when I Xeroxed a bunch of the Dead Kennedy lyrics, it was a Rotten Fruit CD, so I Xeroxed a bunch of those lyrics and then folded them up and sent them back, because on the CD, on the back of the Sublime CD, it said $1 for lyrics, but it never said what kind or who.
Right.
So I thought that would be funny to just start sending out
other people's lyrics. Yeah.
And, you know, as somebody that kind of grew up in that world of just music and writing stuff and getting stuff back, I kind of miss it, you know. And
like,
I love
just that interaction.
Yeah,
anymore.
I love to see. I mean, yeah, we have Twitter. Yeah, we have Instagram. There may be that kind of interaction,
yeah.
But there's still nothing you can hold in your hand. Nothing to collect.
Getting above the noise of Instagram and Twitter is really hard to do. Like, you need. It's almost like those are where your Instagram or your Twitter is like where your dedicated fans will go to.
Right.
But you're not going to be able to stand out and make that connection with somebody that may have not been a fan on Instagram or Twitter.
Yeah.
Or even on, like, I know you said that, like, even on Spotify, like on New Music Fridays, like, it's just not.
Yeah, after 1 week, you forget who was on there the prior week.
Yeah.
You know, and now they have it to 800 on New Music Friday.
Right.
Right? So it becomes more noise.
Like, how does it become a, I mean, it's good if you get on one of those things. But
sure.
I more look at that. Like, when you get on those playlists, more is indicative that you are doing well in other places.
And people do great.
Yeah.
People do wonderful on it.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that what I'm saying is wrong, because this proves otherwise.
Yeah.
It's just as time goes on, people need a human interaction with it.
Right.
And that's why touring does so well.
Yeah.
You know? You could have awesome numbers on Spotify and tour and no one's ever heard you, or you could have awesome numbers on Spotify and how do you work it and tour and everybody knows you and they love you and they can't get enough of you.
Yeah.
You know? So it all depends, you know?
Have you applied those principles to the band that you manage?
Yeah. We're trying really hard to get that going. The band's Oliver Riot.
Yeah.
And myself and Danny both manage the band, and within the last year, I mean, on the Spotify numbers, they're increasing a huge amounts.
Yeah.
And we're all developing together, you know, a perfect and proper way that we think that, how do we cut through the smoke with a lot of folks.
Yeah.
And really come with a show that people are going to remember.
And I think like an actual live performance.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we play live and we're developing new things. You know, by the time this thing airs, we'll have played for, opened for Tom Walker, Ben Lefwich, Tom Grennan. And, you know, we're just going to keep doing more and more and just kind of really develop an interesting show.
Right.
Outside of the regular show that you would kind of think.
Would you say that's like a major key to new artists that are trying to come on the scene?
Individuality has to be.
Okay.
You know, something that's completely different than everybody else's thing.
Right.
For a while, we were just looking at artists that were coming out and it was the same show. Different people, but it became the same show.
What period was that?
Last 3 years.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
You go to certain venues and you're just watching the same thing.
Right.
And you, what is your take home? You know, you got to think, it's like when you see a show, you want to go home the next day or you want to wake up that morning and be like, wow, man, that was just, wow. You know?
Yeah.
To me, the band Fishbone still carries that.
Okay.
Fishbone from LA. If you've never heard of Fishbone, or you've heard their name, there's a documentary called Everyday Sunshine, right? You could find it online. I think YouTube may even have, you know, a version of it. It was on Netflix. But Fishbone was the band that every punk, ska, rock, indie band kind of looked up to.
Really? You know?
And it was actually my first interview on KCRW.
Okay.
And that was 21 years ago.
Yeah.
But this band, live-wise, still carries the torch. Is probably, in my opinion, the best live band you'll ever see.
Really?
The energy. Yeah,
yeah, I'll have to watch their performance videos.
Yeah,
too.
You know, you watch that, it doesn't come across.
Okay.
It just doesn't.
Really?
But when you're there and you know the music and you understand everything about it and what's going on, it kind of blows you away.
Okay.
You know? You know, yeah.
Great.
Well, I learned that because there's another band I work with called Weapon of Choice.
Okay.
It was during the Sublime time.
Yeah.
And Weapon was Lonnie Marshall. His brother was Arik Marshall, who mm-hmm. played with the Chili Peppers. You had like Tom Bone, Kephas, and then these guys often and played with Macy Gray. And then you had Norwood from Fishbone and then Lonnie. They create this group called Trulio Disgracius. And that was a band that also had folks from Fishbone back, you know, in the 80s. And you'd also see them play on stage with George Clinton, you know.
Yeah.
And those kind of shows were amazing. Everybody kind of had signs, you know, with the signs like that. And it was one of those take-home shows.
Right. And you just remember.
You just remember.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where you tell all your friends, like,
you
that,
gotta see
man.
This
oh,
band.
My God. Yeah.
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 I saw... I mean, this is a significantly different genre of music, but my band and I sat down, we watched, we like started studying we watched performance videos because there's this big collection of bootleg performances. Like, you know, obviously there's like Led Zeppelin and there's the Beatles and we had like Ramones and stuff like that. But we watched Green Day like performing in Germany in like the early 2000s, like right after, you know, their international, right before American Idiot. You know what I mean? When they were kind of at that like first really big peak, you know, before they like, you know, got to that next level. And they're just, none of us were really that. I mean, I listened to Green Day when I was like probably 13 or 14, but that was about it. And none of us really did, but we're just like, oh wait, that band is, they're really good. Like there's a reason why they're good. And I just think you can always like appreciate like whatever the genre is, like you can always appreciate a good performance.
You know who Green Day's one of their favorite bands was?
Fishbone?
No, it was Operation Ivy.
Okay.
Which has now become Rancid over the years.
Okay.
Without the lead singer.
Yeah.
But Operation Ivy, both were on Lookout Records.
Yeah.
Back in Berkeley.
Okay.
And that's where Green Day and also Operation Ivy got their start, was all on right. that label.
This is a question that I've got for you. You could probably answer this. What sets Southern California apart as far as music, because I feel like this is like such a nexus of bands, especially in that like late 80s 90s era.
It's funny you ask that, because this was something that a conversation I had the other day about what was it that SoCal had.
Like what was in the water here?
Weed, I guess. I don't know. No, it really was I think there was a freedom growing up in Los Angeles.
Okay.
I'm really intrigued about how folks come from other towns to Los Angeles, and I'll sometimes kind of badger them with questions because I don't understand. I just don't understand their life growing up.
Right.
Let it be a religious background or a conservative background, or even, you know, my wife's from Massachusetts, you're from Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Where it's kind of buttoned up and all this.
Yeah.
Where, you know, I come from a city, and I'm going to lump in San Francisco into this too, because I think SoCal and San Francisco, even though we may have our little rivals going on,
yeah,
we're actually very close,
right?
As a
even
community.
Just the California, yeah, in general.
Yeah. Depends. Where San Diego doesn't necessarily feel like Los Angeles at certain points, but at the same time it does.
Okay,
you know, there you have that Orange County thing that kind of creep into it, you know. But I think there was something liberating about growing up in Los Angeles. We just didn't care, mm-hmm, right? We care about people, but we just didn't care about labels. We didn't care about this. We didn't care about that. You know, it may have started back in the 60s,
okay,
or actually the 50s, you know, because Los Angeles was... Okay, back in the 30s and 20s, Los Angeles was also a hub for jazz.
Right.
You know, you go on Figueroa, and there's these old jazz clubs that used to be there. And, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, music and entertainment was part of our world. So I guess with you may have just come back with entertainment in itself that you just had to let loose, you know?
Right.
And you could be weird and wonky and do drugs and listen to weird things and read weird things. You know, the Beat Generation was both New York and then Los Angeles, and then San Francisco, with all those guys that like City Light Books, and then it kind of bled down to here. The beach life, we had, you know, this freedom of the world where you had like the Beach Boys would come here and it was songs about California, Los Angeles, you know, Malibu, surfing, you know, it was part of our world that we just grew up in. People come here because it's not just the weather. It's just, there's a free attitude that we have here. Right. I have a picture of my grandma in the 60s, with her four sisters, you know, they originally came from Czechoslovakia, and they posed in front of her house in the Fairfax area back in the 60s, and they're all in upside down doing poses, yoga poses and all.
Yeah.
So all this isn't just a millennial thing, you know, today. This is stuff that we've done for years.
Yeah.
You know?
It's like always been a factor.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, I grew up kind of like meditation was popped in my face when I was like 8.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, all the hippie folks and parents and you know, that's what it was like.
Yeah. I noticed like before I moved out here, I was always like, you know how I said like, oh, people wouldn't have guessed I was from Massachusetts. Like I always felt like I was like kind of the more out there hippie person. And then I come here and then I'm like, I feel like I'm from the East Coast. Like I really
feel
like
you get buttoned up.
Yeah, I get buttoned up. And it's
you wanna know a secret?
What's the secret?
You know, we'll talk about this little green stuff here, but I remember growing up, and to show you the kind of culture that was existing, I remember my mom was a teacher, and all the teachers used to come to the house, right? And they have the kids, and we all play.
Mm-hmm.
And the word was herb.
Right.
You know? I didn't know what it was. It smelled different, but we're smoking herb.
Right.
And that was something from the 70s and 80s, man. I just remember my whole life.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So do you think that's... I mean, that's got to be a factor in...
Oh, it, yeah. In I mean, look, and then, you know, being with my uncle up in San Francisco...
Right.
We had family friends that live on a commune, and I remember going up, you know, north of the Russian River up there and spending, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks in a shack...
Right.
You know, and it wasn't like a communist commune. It was just, you know, just a bunch of hippies.
Right.
Tripping out, you know, and just, you know, I'm preteen doing that.
Right.
Yeah. How often do you go to a party and people just start busting out instruments and start playing?
not really that often.
Yeah. See, that's something I grew up with.
Yeah.
That was normal.
Yeah.
That, you know, you're with a band, everybody would just start jamming and playing.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I know a few folks that I've been at house things with them here, and they've done that. But for the most part, that again was something that was part of how you grew up. You know, you had, we didn't have headphones at all.
Right.
No one cared about headphones. That's only when you had like a Walkman, you use a headphone. So you go to a friend's house and you bust out like a Minutemen record, right? And you guys are looking at the whole thing.
Yeah.
And then after that's done, someone else would throw something else on while you're watching Inspector Gadget on TV, the cartoons, you know? And then you go outside and skateboard and do whatever. I mean, that was our after school or weekends. And so, you know, that part of music was kind of like, was the creativity that you were immersed into. Then you would go to record stores and start finding things that you normally don't listen to.
Yeah. Well, it was a lot more physical and it was a lot more tangible. Because now...
But you have the Spotify, which you would think people would search, but I don't know. I personally don't know.
Yeah.
People actually search for music as they used to. You want it to be like the good old days or when I was younger, because... I think you get, I mean, I know, I get envious of the youth.
Right.
I get envious that I want to know what it was like. I want to be part of that once again. But I'm not. And, you know you're not. And there was something about being young that was just so beautiful and so refreshing. You know, you know, just speaking truth on this. But at the same time, there's a flip to it that when you get older, you wish you weren't young.
Right.
And you understand why it kind of was weird to be young, you know, and why young people looked up to the older folks and all that. So there's this weird duality of getting older and how I love being older, you know? Yeah. I wish I was young, but I don't want to be young.
Yeah. Well, because now you have all the perspective.
Yeah, it's kind of like you just want to be invited to the party, but you don't necessarily want to go.
Like you don't want to be the party.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, you just want to be invited. And I think that kind of changes over the years. And then you just realize, well, I have my own parties now.
Yeah.
And it's a party with these guys and these folks. And we may reminisce, but then our thoughts, our things are so much different now.
Yeah.
Because you have experience and wisdom and I don't know. Again, making this up, but
yeah. Of course. I mean it's still a value. You've had a really long career, so like this is still important stuff.
Well, I've had a bouncy career.
Yeah.
I start bouncing and not scatterbrain, but just like kinda like bouncing, like, okay, I did this. Now I kinda wanna dab into this and you know, and I got a friend, we grew up together and he loves to do crazy things like skydive and, you know, all that, you know, bungee and all that kind of stuff that I wouldn't even get close to. That's just nuts for me, you know, but he enjoys doing that kind of stuff.
Right.
I look at it as like different careers and different things in life that I've done and just kind of want to grab and do. Cause people say, well, you always done so many things. Why don't you just focus on one? I'm like, that's boring.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I think my whole family was like that.
Yeah.
You know,
it's important to diversify.
Yeah.
You know, cause I think I feel like the people that become really successful at one specific thing are outliers because they only want to do that one specific thing. But I think everybody has that. Nobody wants to do the same thing for 40 years straight.
Some people do.
Some people do. But like, I don't know. I feel like it's such a high standard to hold yourself to say like, this is the one thing that I need to do.
I got
to
tell you, for folks that work in music, you should always have a hobby.
Right.
That is not music.
Okay.
Always have a hobby that is not music because... You turn music into your hobby becomes your profession, then you don't have a break away from it.
Right.
And if it just becomes too much, you're going to wake up one day and you're going to be like, man, what do I do?
Yeah.
Where do I go? You know, what do I feel unfulfilled. You know, what do I do?
Yeah.
And it's important, I think, to have, and it could be I make candles.
Right.
For folks. I've taught people I make candles. I made soap. I shoot photos. Weird things, you know?
The more that you diversify outside of music, especially as a musician, the better your music is going to end up being.
Right.
Because you're bringing all this extra life experience into it. Because if you're just only consuming music, it's just going to be...
Well, think about that. Okay, so all the people that bring their outside world into it, too.
Yeah.
marketing and music. Do you find this hard today?
Marketing music?
Yeah.
You know, we've tried a bunch of different things. Do you know what I mean? We've tried like, oh, we're just going to do Facebook and Instagram and blogs. But now we're like, okay, well, how can we break it in a different way?
Right.
Like, what's the different thing that we can do? And it's funny that you brought up the mail thing and like how people would send fan mail and,
yeah,
and doing that type of correspondence that you can touch and stuff. So we're really interested in those kinds of things.
You know, here's the actual true story. My uncle had hooked me up with Ziggy Marley's fan mail.
Really?
Right.
Yeah.
And I used to get 7-inch records and postcards and notes and all this from the whole Ziggy camp.
Yeah.
And I remember a few years ago when I first met Ziggy for the first time, I told him, I said, man, I just got to say something. I was one of the original members of your fan club that came out. And he just laughed. And he says, you still have that stuff? And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
Still have it in a box.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably every correspondent I've ever gotten, I keep aside. I've kept aside.
Really?
You know, yeah.
Do you think that's something, is that something that you guys are going to pursue with your band?
Absolutely. We've already started here and there, little things. So,
yeah.
You know, pictures I've made taken and the boys sign it and send it out.
Yeah.
Because that's important. I think the interaction. I got to tell you something about the Oliver Riot things is one thing that we're seeing a lot of is we get a lot of dance interpretation, right?
Really?
So people will find the music. We still don't know exactly where everybody's finding this stuff. Right?
Yeah.
People will find it, and we just get videos constantly sent to us and folks online doing dance interpretations. Let's say like one of their songs, Harder or Ivory Black or something like that.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't be the first thing I would think of to do a dance to.
Really?
Yeah, because you're really close to the music. And you're not even thinking in that world. You're not thinking, oh, all of a sudden people are dancing to this and to their own interpretations.
Yeah.
Now, that's a trip, man. And that's like, wow.
It's like they're adding their own art to it.
And then you think, well, what do they see that I miss? What did they see that we all missed? You know? Right. Because I that wasn't the first thing I ever thought of. You know, but when I first heard the music and I first, you know, there was a song called We Pop the Moon that I first fell in love with. And I look at music as visual at the same time, hence the supervision, all this.
Yeah.
When I listen to songs, I have a whole video that goes on in my head.
Right.
And it's hard to explain it.
Like you get the visual.
I get a visual.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I can't explain it.
Okay.
Can't explain it all. I don't know how to interpret it. I can't explain it and tell you what I'm seeing. But there's a lot of energy going on in my head at that given time when I, especially watch a song or listen to a song I really love. Mm-hmm. And then I do it on repeat and repeat and repeat. And sometimes I'll repeat a song 5-6 times in a row and just like listen to everything.
Right.
You know, and drop it down, bring it up, you know, and just kind of really get immersed into it.
Right.
Yeah. And that's what I did with that first track. And, after that, I reached out to them and I thought this is just beyond beautiful. And it was a gamble for them.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have an experience on it.
Yeah.
But there was something about it, something about them that was life altering for me.
Really?
Yeah. Something. I don't know what it is. I still don't know what it is.
Interesting.
But there's something there that was life altering.
It's always, I feel like the artists and the musicians that can build a world to bring you into are the ones that end up having the most staying power, like the most, like they pull you in.
They pull you in and you don't know why.
Yeah.
And you don't know why. It goes like, you know, one thing I think is important for kids today, I shouldn't say kids today. That's such a bad thing to say. I think one important for people who are music fans, There are a few questions that we should all ask each other as music fans.
Yeah.
What is that album? What is that one album? Mm-hmm. Okay. And what does it do for you?
Yeah.
You know, there is one album that hits you.
Yeah.
Right. We used to call it the desert album. You know, if you're on a desert, an island.
A desert island. Yeah.
What is the album you would bring? You know, of course, everybody's like, hey, it's Stairway to Heaven and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Okay. After about 10 minutes, I'm bored. All right.
Yeah.
But what is the album that you have that really changes your life? Because there's that album that made you become who you are in this business, in music business.
Yeah.
You know, mine was Bob Marley's Confrontation. And I think before me, it was because I was 13 years old and visiting family friends in Colorado Springs. And I think that was probably one of my favorite summers, not because of what we did, but it was such vivid memories.
Right.
So with my uncle, all my uncles, or my uncle's best friend growing up. So they're quite older, and then all their friends. And I was the only 13-year-old kid, right? And, you know, one guy was, and this was the 80s, one guy who's a machine gunner in Vietnam, you know, and he's talking about some stories but not getting into it. Another guy who had a magic shop, right? And fishing and going kayaking and going hiking and eating a cheesecake out of a Frisbee while hiking, you know, all these things added together.
Yeah.
And putting on this record while I was out there, that became my anthem. Was right. that experience,
yeah,
that summer. And even today, when I get up in an airplane or land in an airplane, or happy or sad, that is the album that completely balances me out, you know?
Yeah.
My dad died. I had to listen to the album, right? Yeah. Got married, put on the album.
Yeah.
You know, that was it. It is my security blanket is music.
Yeah.
And then the other question is, what is your favorite music experience? You know, I think that's an important thing to ask each other, because not favorite thing you've done in music. Oh, I saw U2 play. No.
Right.
What was the experience? You have an experience.
Right.
That you did. Are you familiar with Little Jimmy Scott?
I don't think so.
He's a jazz musician. Okay. He has since passed, but I got the opportunity before he died to produce a show at the Echo here in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And it was myself and the actor Adam Goldberg. Adam had done a movie called Scotch and Milk or something like that.
Yeah.
Brilliant movie. I've seen it. Absolutely love it. It's like a film noir. The soundtrack's all jazz, you know. And we got together and we actually put on a show with Little Jimmy Scott. And wheeling him out, because he wasn't able to get out of his chair, and, you know, putting him on stage and introducing him, watching a little of the film, that was an experience that actually made me tear up.
Right.
You know, when I'm getting all emotional from this stuff, but from actually wheeling him on stage, standing next to him as the crowd's going nuts, because he's like, you know, as far as like jazz, I kind of get giddy over jazz musicians.
Yeah.
That was probably one of my favorite music experiences. And that's what I'm saying for you. What is your experience? What makes you? What makes you who you are?
Yeah.
You know, what is your earworm?
Yeah.
You know, what is your musical earworm? How deep do you get into it? You know, or do you just go on a Spotify and listen to stuff, or you dig into it? You know, have you ever gone onto the streaming service and said, two tears in a bucket, man, I'm just going to start bringing up some stuff I've never even heard. Not New Music Friday, not indie playlists, not, you know, whatever it is. But, you know, something that you know, we're talking about Beat Generation. Maybe Jack Kerouac or William S. Burroughs did stuff with Disposable Heroes of Hypocrisy, right? And also did it with Kurt Cobain. You know, here you have interjection between, it's kind of like a new non-dualistic approach into listening to music, where you have a guy who primarily does writing, you know, pretty out there beat writing, and probably pretty out there music, and you put these guys together, and what do you have, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the kind of stuff that's how you kind of jump forward into the brain.
It's like combining all these things.
Yeah.
Is that
a non-dualistic approach?
Is that the class that you teach?
Yeah, so that's what we do. We do, you know, how, think of the band Diantward.
Right.
Okay, absolutely love them, but yeah. Dig into it.
Yeah.
Right? Dig into why are they Diantward? What do you see when you see them? I'm going to ask you that.
I mean, they're rappers.
Okay.
But they're also like DJ, they're also like, you know, dance MCs, but they're also this like really weird, it's almost like a
Have you seen them before?
Punk. Yeah.
Okay.
I've seen them before.
I want you to think about them outside of them being rappers.
Right.
What is it? What are they?
They're artists.
Right. Yeah. What kind of artists?
Performance artists.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, and part of that performance artists, they take a non-dualistic approach to things. And what that means is you look at guys like Steve Jobs, who thus has computer into marketing and all this, right? So what did Steve Jobs do prior to become that? He took an outside form, like going to an ashrams and going to India and learned marketing in a different way, and put it into approach of how Apple became Apple, right?
Right.
If you watch the early Diane Ward, and then there's a point where everything got different, right? Right. They met a guy named Roger Balin, who was originally from the United States, lived in South Africa. And Roger was most known for taking pictures of insane asylums or people who had complete mental deficiencies in that, just absolutely crazy folks.
Yeah.
To weird folks, whatever it is. And you've seen these pictures, and you look at them, and you're like, oh my God, this is haunting.
Yeah.
And all the cartoons and all that. So you watch the video, I Think You Freaky, mm-hmm. and it says directed by Ninja and Roger Balin. Yeah. Well, they had gotten together, and Roger had created all a lot of the imagery. And that imagery became Diane Ward. Their relationship got together, and they created this whole style, this really cool, you know, approach and style. And so since then, you see all this really cool, weird stuff, you know. And then they did Chappie, you know. They did the Harmony Korine video that you'll watch, all taking on that original yeah. Roger Balin style.
Yeah. Who are some other artists that are doing that
today?
How do you feel about Kanye West? Because I feel like Kanye does that kind of stuff.
Kanye took the Mirigami stuff, the Japanese thing. You know, I don't know how much he's actually part of his album work and all that kind of things, you know, because you don't really see it beyond the album cover.
Right.
But when we do talk about that in class, I bring up, you know, Mirigami and Kanye West.
Yeah.
I've often thought that bands, hip hop or rap bands, I should say, back in the 80s, like Native Tongue groups that all Prince Paul did, mm-hmm. kind of had that. That was like De La Soul and Tribe Called Quest, and their approach was a little different because their approach to the records was just a little bit different to me because, you know, they added the skits to the thing, so these became storybooks in a way, right? You know, so everything kind of flowed, and I think learning from that, how they synchronized all the music together. So it wasn't like, you know, single song, song, single song, song, single song, song, you know, 1, 3, and 6 and all that stuff. And then maybe 12, but there was a different approach, to how the kind of the albums were kind of laid out.
Right. Like they flowed.
Yeah. Kendrick Lamar did that too. Yeah. You know, for a more modern day thing.
Yeah.
Outside of that, you know, the old classic rock stuff like Pink Floyd, you know, they were kind of bringing in art into the world of music. I can't really think of the top of my head who does it. You know, there is an artist named Cosmo Sheldrake who's out of the UK, and I do see some of his stuff that's pretty trippy.
Yeah.
And his music. And if you ever listen to the Cosmo, the way he sings and his phrasings and the kind of music it is, it's almost like a modern day Oingo Boingo in a way, where you could visually see the oddness, the weirdness with it. In your head, you could see like mushrooms growing, you know? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know that feeling.
The old Walt Disney cartoon things where everybody's high and tripping.
Pink elephants.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you listen to his music, you visualize that in your head. That is so weird.
Yeah.
But there's something about it. I'm also drawn to it constantly.
It takes you there.
Yeah. Cosmo Sheldrake is his name. You know, to bring back to my Oliver Riot guys, their albums are also synchronized in a really brilliant way. They kind of all fit together. They're on the second EP, there's a recording of a gentleman in the background talking. And if you listen to what he's saying, the conversations kind of lead into the next song, right? And
yeah.
Every song kind of is based off of where this conversation is. Yeah. So both Ben and Alex, the way they put things together to me is just absolutely, again, back to brilliance again. Because there's something else than just synchronizing. There's storyboards that go on.
I feel like it's an extra puzzle to solve. Or it's like an extra reward for the people that are listening to the music that like it. And then they go back and they're like, I never noticed this before. Is this the Oliver Sacks stuff, this non-duality stuff?
Was this what that has to do with it? Oliver Sacks, he probably one of the most brilliant professors. If you're not familiar, those who are listening, pick up, you know the movie Awakenings that Robin Williams was in, right? Oliver Sacks is a professor and also a huge music fan. He's got a book about musicophilia that is about, I guess, more the brain's reaction to music.
Okay.
With dopamine and serotonin and blah, 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 and all that kind of stuff. And also there's another guy named John. God, what is John's name? I forgot. I'll find it. And then David Byrne had a book out, What Music.
Yeah, I've read some of that.
All right.
How Music Works.
Yeah, there's an audio book version of it.
Mm-hmm.
Treat Yourself. Listen to it.
Yeah.
I'll give it to you.
Yeah.
Different than the written.
Really?
Yeah.
Because he probably references the music in it, does he?
Yeah, not just that, but the way they describe things about like going into a, you know, they'll do marketing where they go into a focus group and they'll go into a liquor store and they'll play French music, right? And they watch the people and they see there are two shelves. There's Italian wines and French wines in this wine store. And they have Italian music going on in the background, right? And they take the first half of the focus group, they go in, and what kind of wines do they pick?
Probably the Italian.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So then they'll do the same thing with the second half of the focus group, and they'll play French music.
Yeah.
Or Italian, what did I say the first time? But the opposite, and they go in there.
French wine.
And they take the French wines.
Yeah.
And they notice that when you do these kind of things, like restaurants will do this, where restaurants will have playing fast music, kind of will get people to go out. Whereas sit downs, play nice slow music, you know, and it all depends on how long do you want to keep the people there. The fast music, like a fast food restaurant or kind of a, you know, like a whatever kind of thing, in and out, gone, right? Chances are you're not going to be there. But if it's maybe it's a bar or it's a very nice restaurant, they make their money on the booze. And the music's in there, it's kind of slow. And, you know, you may end up staying there and it's kind of a different reaction. How do you listen to the music and the ambiance and, you know, and it kind of leaves you in there a bit longer.
Do you think that the people that pick those playlists know what they're doing specifically? Like, okay, we need to do this because you were going to want people
to
stay.
Look, working on commercials, it's the same thing. You know, doing music on commercials, it's the same thing. Do you want them... You know, so, you know, some of the briefs that we get, it is like, okay, so here's a commercial. We want the people to stop from getting up and walking into the other room. Or let's say they're halfway into the other room to go to the bathroom.
Right.
And that song comes on with the commercial. Yeah. We want them to stop, turn around and look and walk over to the TV and see what that commercial is.
Yeah.
You know, and that was like the power of the music and all that. Versus there are background music. It could be whatever song on there that just, it doesn't matter.
It's like you don't want it to be, like you don't even want to know that it's there.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. But there's an esoteric approach to doing it too, that it's very left to center sometimes and it works. You think of like soundtracks on films, like Gus Van Sant or that they would just do songs you normally wouldn't think make any sense on paper. But these songs absolutely work. Once you hear it, you get it. But back to Oliver, you know, he did Awakenings and he did all these approach with folks and music as well. That's what Music Philly is about. And just different receptions, that dopamine receptions that you have when you hear a piece of music. What is your response to it?
Right.
My friend Austin, he was born deaf and he got these implants in his ears and we would actually have him speak to the class and I would have him sit in front of the class and I'd play music for the first time of artists that we knew growing up.
Yeah.
And I would kind of see like his, you know, his response. I did that with Nick Drake. Pink Moon was a track I did. Mm-hmm. And that was Pink Moon. Nick Drake was on a real commercial years and years ago, which ended, you know, that's another thing I use in class that talks about these tracks that just kind of resonate and just bring you in. And so back to Austin, we'd have him talk to the class, and the class would ask some questions about being deaf.
Right.
And how his response would be, you know, and how he hears things for the first time, and how when we listen to music versus how he listens to music and how he hears it is just amazing.
What's the major difference?
The way his ears work and with the earpieces, he's able to hear every instrument in a different way.
Really?
His brain's still learning how to work properly. So we have everything as a linear line as far as like when we hear things. He's able to branch it up and down, like, you know, like a hillside.
Right.
When we hear conversations, you could hear me talking right now, right? But then you hear that in the background, yeah. Right? Sometimes your hearing goes focused to that knocking or then comes back to my voice, right? Right. Now, of course, it's going to there. Now you're listening to the knick-knack, right? Yeah. And it's kind of changed the patterns.
Yeah.
So, but it's kind of like a depth of field of your hearing, right? So for him, what it sounds like is like this. So he just hears everything where it comes together.
Right. It's like compressed.
Right. So his brain has to learn how to separate the different sounds.
Right.
So when he hears music or he hears things in the background, he'll actually have to tone it down so it comes to a perfect sound. And then the machines, the little earpieces, will kind of separate for him, and then his brain is able to learn how to separate.
Can work with it.
Yeah, and we learned that at being as a child.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, I asked him, I said, well, what's it like before the earpieces? How do you hear music? And he says, through vibrations.
Right.
So he's able to hear the low end of a song and the...
Yeah.
And that's how he respond to it. I sent him a video once of a theremin. Right, there's a theremin online, and they do. I don't know. Everybody, every video online with a theremin is always like, "What? God, man, with Dorothy, Wizard of Oz."
Yeah,
yeah. He heard that song online, and was so fascinated with the sound that the theremin makes. It's an awful sound, yes. But it's an interesting sound.
It's right? Weird.
I bought a saw.
Yeah.
Right. So I could play the musical saw. And so he had the theremin, I had the musical saw, and so it was like, and he loved this theremin so much because it was such a weird, different sound he's never ever heard before. He went out and bought one, and he plays it just like he can't hear.
Really?
Yeah, because he sounds terrible.
Yeah.
And I keep kidding him with that.
Yeah.
I keep telling him, put it away.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, no, by playing this odd instrument, this odd sound, he resonated to it so much.
Right.
And I found that absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's like at just an entirely different, like his brain is just not wired
right
for it.
Right.
And it's kind of crazy too, like how he can rewire his brain.
Well, his brain has to rewire for
exactly.
it.
Exactly. And that's crazy.
But imagine that. Imagine being deaf and hearing for the first time. And imagine that. We don't think about certain things. We think about, okay, so here's a voice and he has to put it together. We say the word cat.
Right. Right?
Now, he has to relearn. He knows that the word cat is a kitty.
Right.
But he has to learn the word cat in itself.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, it's like this signifier and the signified.
Yeah.
Like, is the whole sign.
Yeah.
So like we think of it like cat is like one thing. Like there's no difference between a cat and the word cat. But I think this is also when you're learning a language, but in his case, like what he has to think of the signifier of cat.
Yeah.
And then the signified, which is in his mind, cat.
Of what a cat looks like.
What a cat looks like, the actual physical
and the
animal.
Sound of it.
And the sound.
So he has to say right. The word.
Right.
Know the sound and what the image is.
Right.
At the same time, or whatever that object is,
yeah,
you know. So there's like a few things that he has to put together. Whereas, like you said, we grow up, we learn this as a baby,
yeah,
because our heads are doing all this. I put him there because when we approach music, or you approach music in a certain way, you know, it really opens the kids' heads up.
Yeah.
On how to listen to things different.
It definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely does. It's actually interesting. So I have a hearing condition called hyperacusis, which means it's just from listening to loud music for a really, like, I've damaged my ears.
I'm trying that club.
And, well, it's like, I already had tinnitus for a long time, right. So my ears ring, but it's kind of like a, you know, a certain subset of people get tinnitus, and then another certain subset of people get hyperacusis, which is hearing sensitivity. So I have to, like, so my hearing is actually, like, hypersensitive. So, you know, for example, my neighbors next door right now, their fire alarm is out of batteries.
Right.
And that beep sound just is like, it's like pins and needles over
for,
like,
you,
for me, just because of my whole brain has, like, basically, like, I've overloaded the circuits in my ears, essentially.
I had a dog that did that. She'd freak out every time she heard a fire.
It wouldn't be just a fire alarm.
Like a smoke alarm.
Keys will do it. You know what I mean? Those weird high frequencies and stuff. Like, when it was really bad before I started, like, going to therapy for it and, you know, making steps to improve it, like, my girlfriend's voice would, like, send those pins and needles things.
Yeah, well, let me tell you about that. That's not pins and needles, man. That's just reality.
Yeah, no. But going back to the music thing is, like, one of my, like, things that I have to do for therapy is actually listening to music at a louder volume than, slightly louder than I would be comfortable with to reacquaint myself. Just, like, putting on headphones and just closing my eyes and just getting in and listening to music. And it's been the first time in a long time that I've actually just sat down only to listen to music.
Right.
And, like, kind of refinding, like, well, what am I going to listen to today to, like, and, like, so I'll go and listen to, like, four or five Led Zeppelin songs, and I'll discover things that I didn't hear because I normally put it on the background.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes you just hear things you have never heard before.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny you say that. There are a few songs. There's two songs. One is Richie Havens doing Here Comes the Sun on an album called Alarm Clock, where he does the word mmm, right? And also Ted Hawkins, Biloxi Blues, Biloxi something.
Yeah.
And it was his last album before he died. And he plays this guitar, and he hits something with the guitar. I wish we had one right here, but it's right there. It sounds like birds, but all he's doing is taking the guitar and running along the strings.
Yeah.
Right? And it makes this noise.
Yeah.
And that piece, that little thing, and that that Richie does, is, like you said, it's these one little tiny things in there that just kind of draw you in, and you hear things for, like, the first time, and then all of a sudden that becomes a song.
Yeah, like, you can't not notice that part.
You can't not notice it, but that becomes the actual favorite piece of your song. Things that are happy accidents or things that are just not meant as part of the song itself, something that they do, the human element of what they do in it, all of a sudden brings it in, and you're just, oh my God, this is a song. This is it. That's it.
Yeah.
You know?
It's interesting. Do you think there was a period of time when that was happening more often, or do you think it's always been?
To me, there's a lot more perfection that goes on with music.
Okay.
And there's a lot less perfection. I think because, well, in blues and rock and all that, and punk, you could get away with perfection. With no perfection.
Right.
Whereas pop, dance music, there's more,
as much wiggle room.
It's not much, you know, no wiggle room at all.
Yeah.
But on blues, you could get up to get that blues singer that goes, the cough, you know, that great cough that I hear on a lot of different things.
And, yeah. That's what makes it.
What makes it.
Yeah.
That's when you listen to it and you're like, man. I get it. And I feel it. I feel him sitting here, you know. Yeah. I feel that artist sitting here. Rock did the same thing, you know. There used to be I remember the Beatles did it. I think it was Paul's Dead. You know, you kind of
I buried Paul.
Yeah, I buried Paul, and you got to listen to it, and you wanted to hear what he was saying.
Yeah.
Accent or not, it's just one of those things that happen.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with editing on TV shows. You know, you watch, like, old TV. One of my favorite shows is NYPD Blue. And when I worked at Fox, I used to watch them film that show. And I was lucky enough to be on set a few times and watch how they do it. And I'm fascinated with that. It's all shot like a play, right?
Yeah.
And they do three takes, two takes, three takes max. and they have different camera angles. And what the editor does is, because of the three takes, they'll end up editing different pieces of the take. And so sometimes you get that improv moment in there, and you know, that was absolutely real.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same thing that you see in music.
Do you think, because of the social and political climate that we're going into, that maybe the industry or your listeners or just the whatever you're going to call it is more primed for that raw rock punk vibe? And I think to an extent that might be happening. What do you think about that?
You know, as far as where's music going, is pop always going to be pop? Sure. And it's always going to be there.
Yeah.
Is hip hop at its pinnacle? Probably not.
Yeah.
It's just going to be consistent. I think we're spending way too much time working, you know, looking at analytics and so worried about what the numbers are on Spotify and right. Apple and all this kind of thing. I know, was it Tim Cook recently said something about we are not about analytics, we're about human
right.
touch or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's just going to come to a point where you know, it goes to a generational thing as much as the millennials get shit on.
Right.
You have a Z generation who are going out there, and if it isn't for the school shootings, all those kids that are, you know, absolute heroes going out there and speaking up for yeah. what they truly believe
yeah.
because they experienced something so horrific
yeah.
and it wasn't some rhetoric, you know, that they heard at school or whatever. I mean, they lived through this kind of thing and you can't take that away from them, their experiences. That we're seeing a generation shift with a lot of kids today with the books, just doing more humanistic approaches to things, not relying on their boxes so much, not using dating apps necessarily, but actually reading books, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, you watch and you see what the response is. And for a generation, we haven't had any angst. We've been pretty apathetic, hence our political climate, what it's turned into. And now we're seeing something that is starting to really gin folks up and do things that they've never done before and go out and fight for things they've never fought for. You know, it's no longer, well, it's not in my backyard, so I don't care.
Right.
It's now, it's in my backyard, so I do care. And it's in their backyard, and I do care. And it's in their backyard, and I do care. And it's in their backyard, and I do care. You know?
Yeah.
And we haven't seen that in a while.
Yeah.
And, you know, back in the 80s, that had a lot to do with a lot of the music movements with, like, punk rock. And, you know, you got that with grunge music also up in Seattle, too, you know, where it was a collectiveness. It was a collectiveness of people and society. It wasn't just they showed up to a club at nighttime and, you know, saw a band played and then split and
right.
then looking for everybody who can see me and all this kind of stuff.
You yeah.
know, everybody kind of hung out. It was this group. And I'm seeing a lot more of that harder rock stuff come back and punk come back. I mean, you could look at what England has. You could look at what Ireland has.
Yeah.
And you're kind of hearing that. You know, I mean, they had the Brexit first.
Yeah.
And that might be a their response.
Yeah.
And then we've had our things second, you know.
Brexit too.
Yeah. So we're looking at, you know, different actions, you know. And I would love to dig in because we are in a bubble in ourselves and to see what, you know, politically the other side of folks are, because, you know, people that listen, you can't knock people's political beliefs whatsoever.
Right.
You can understand them.
Yeah.
You can learn about them. You don't have to agree with them,
yeah.
but you shouldn't knock them. And see what their angst is, you know,
what are their fears?
Yeah. Not just fears, but what is their angst? You know, what are they doing? You know, what are they listening to? You know, we're going to think, okay, here's our thought process of that. Oh, you know, they're conservative. So they're just hillbillies listening to country and all that. And that's just not true.
Yeah.
You know, what is their reaction to music and what are they starting to listen to? You know?
Yeah.
Which I think is important too.
Definitely.
You know, have they gone back to rock music? You know, is Bruce Springsteen selling more records? You know, even though that may not be the the thing.
Yeah.
You know, is country changing a little bit?
Yeah.
You know, is twangy or is it kind of gotten up and a little more robust, you know?
Started getting 808s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, there's something to that. To me, America's kind of used to be on the forefront of music, but
yeah.
We're kind of on the tail end now.
Yeah.
You look at Japan and see who some of the biggest artists are there,
yeah.
Like bands like 1OK Rock.
Yeah.
But they have like 70,000-80,000 people at every concert. And it's mind-blowing. But then yeah. The same band comes here and nobody shows up.
Right.
But saying that, that's kind of this like heavy stuff. But then you look, well, is this going to last because Warped Tour is now no longer? Or maybe it was just time to let it go.
Yeah.
You know, you can't dig into it too much. Me personally, I think there's going to be a resurgence on the guitar again and rock and drums and all this other stuff. And
yeah.
Just kind of a change and breaking that fourth wall again.
Well, the same thing that people, like you were saying, that you're seeing younger kids go for more of hardware.
Yeah.
Like things that you can interact with, like with your hands.
Yeah.
I bet they're going to want to go after that music that's yeah. that visceral.
Rock is all, real. Yeah, breaks the fourth wall big time, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's just performed for you.
Yeah.
You know, it's actually, you can see it.
Yeah.
It's tangible.
Yeah.
And it almost, too, goes back to what you're talking about.
And you could play it. You could play it with the air things.
Yeah.
You can't exactly do that with a lot of other musics. There's
yeah.
not, you know, it's hard to feel like you're doing it.
Yeah.
You could sing lyrics, but you're not. It's like with dance music. What are you going to pretend you're on the ones and twos and doing this all the time?
Yeah.
Just, you're dancing and it's part of the show and all this stuff. But, you know, you see some of these rock bands and how, you know, the whole audience is playing the guitar or playing the drums and, you know, playing the bass and all that. You got an audience singing the songs and pretending they're playing instruments at the same time. That's
right.
Like immersing into the whole.
Yeah.
Into the whole thing.
It's like the full mind body.
But that's going to change.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're listening to music a different way now, you know, and eventually we'll still listen to it that way. But eventually, you know, it was on the bottom, we'll gravitate towards the tops.
Right.
Once again.
Yeah.
And then it will go away again.
Yeah.
And then it'll come back. That's just how it works.
Do you think, with talking about rock and roll, do you think it has to be guitar and bass and drums, or do you think it's a mentality more than it is?
Punk's a mentality.
Right.
You know, the yeah. music is, but punk's mentality isn't it's not like motorcycle drivers who have a BMW bike.
Right.
And it's on the weekend.
Yeah.
Punk is a mentality that's an everyday thing. You right. have to be that.
Like the hippie thing.
Yeah. You know, I started listening to ska and punk back in the 80s, and that was me, you know. I dressed
right.
the part, looked the part, you date the part. I drove a car that was like it, you know. I had a Vespa. Even today I still have the same colors and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm wearing Dear Keep Your Kids Off Drug shirt,
yeah,
with a J, you know. And it was just the more of a mentality,
right,
that you grew up with.
Yeah.
You know, the two tears in a bucket, fuck it. George Clinton said that, and I absolutely love that.
It's great.
Yeah. No, and that, and punk wasn't just about the music. That was the music that came out of it.
Right.
But, you know, we were direct, we were pretty much, our parents were also hippies, and I don't mean hippies that just sat there and had flowers in their hands. You know, my mom and my dad were at People's Park during the riots in Berkeley. I remember protesting as a kid, you know, during the Iraq One War. You know, a lot of family friends were out there, you know,
yeah,
embracing, you know, let's make a change here. And then, of course, you see shows and all this kind of stuff growing up. But, yeah, no, punk, and I think the result of that was the punk rock, especially in the 80s with the political climate at the same time.
Yeah.
But you're much able to express yourself, I think, back then than you could today. Without getting shut down.
Yeah.
Too many trolls.
Yeah.
You know, and you have a president that shuts everybody down. So it's like, we've kind of lost our way, is who we were, is like, you know, reactionaries. And we all should have voices. That's the other thing, too.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what your beliefs are. We should all have a voice.
There you go.
It's true.
Yeah.
And saying that, The one thing that I would love to see is musicians stepping up and having
a voice.
Yeah. Expressing their voice. Don't be afraid.
Yeah.
That's the point of it is don't be afraid anymore. You shouldn't be afraid. You know, music is art. If artists do it, if painters do it, if whatever does it, stand up there and do it, man. Do something you're not used to doing and shake it up.
Hell yeah.
Gotta shake it up.
Yeah.
Because that's where it comes in. That's your punk rock, is shaking it up.
That's great.
All right.
Thanks, Jason. So that's our show. If you want to keep up with all the Industry Talks news and attend our September panel, check us out online at industrytalks.net. If you want to support the podcast, the best way to do that is to leave us a 5-star rating and, if you're up to it, a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening.